6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting Turkey suffers yet another fatal bombing attack. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed to avenge Wednesday's car bombing in central Ankara that killed at least 28 and wounded dozens. The blast occurred as a convoy of military buses stopped for a traffic light at an intersection close to the parliament and military headquarters.
Olay yerindeki en ufak, en ince
Turkish Prime Minister Numan Kurtulmaz said an investigation is underway, but there's no information regarding who was responsible. The Islamic State has been blamed for last October's suicide bombing at a peace rally in Ankara that killed more than 100. Turkey has also been battling the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, which has been waging a 30-year guerrilla campaign for more autonomy. The opening of some polling stations in Uganda has been delayed as voters prepared to cast ballots in presidential and parliamentary elections. At least 5 polling stations were still waiting for delivery of ballot papers after polls were to have opened. 8 candidates are competing for the presidency, with incumbent Yoweri Museveni and challenger Kizza Besigye considered the top contenders. Besigye, having completed his 4th campaign against the incumbent, said he expects the process will be neither free nor fair.
If we consider that this election is fraudulent to the extent that we reject the outcome, we shall do so. We shall make that recommendation to them that this is what we found. We don't consider that this election is something that we can respect. We therefore reject its outcome.
Mr. Museveni has held the presidency for the past 30 years, since the end of a civil war that ravaged the country for 5 years, ending in 1986. His other main challenger, former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi, the 71-year-old Mr. Museveni, credited with restoring peace process and presiding over growth. This is VOA News. The northward advance of forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, with heavy backing from Russian airstrikes, is hampering U.S. efforts to combat the Islamic State in Syria. Defense spokesman Colonel Steve Warren said, while the government's offensive has not substantially weakened U.S.-backed rebels fighting the IS group, it could happen.
Yes, we are concerned that forces that we're working with to focus on Daesh are focused on other things, but we certainly understand it. You know, this is a civil war. There's a civil war going on in Syria right now. Civil wars are messy. Civil wars are complicated. Civil wars have friction. Civil wars have confusion. And that's what we see playing out here.
He said there are indications moderate rebel groups are shifting resources from their fight with Islamic State, along with so-called Mara Line, which extends from the northern town of Mara to the Turkish border, to try to counter the regime's advance. Doctors Without Borders said Wednesday rescuers pulled 3 wounded people from the rubble of a hospital in northern Syria, destroyed in an airstrike Monday. The medical charity said 11 were confirmed killed. The responsibility for the airstrike remains unclear. More than 100 UN trucks Wednesday brought desperately needed humanitarian aid, including food and medicine, to 5 Syrian towns under siege by both Syrian forces and its opposition. Nearly 100,000 will receive some relief as a result of an agreement between Damascus and the UN. The UN Special Envoy for Yemen told the Security Council on Wednesday that deep divisions among the warring factions prevent him from calling for a new round of peace talks. Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed told the Security Council the parties are divided over whether a new round of talks should be convened with or without a new cessation of hostilities. He also said the nearly one-year-old conflict between the Saudi-backed government and Iranian-supported Shia Houthi rebels has killed more than 6,000 and wounded more than 35,000. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel Wednesday said it's in Germany's national interest that Britain remain in the European Union. She called Prime Minister David Cameron's proposals for EU reforms justified and necessary. An EU summit Thursday and Friday in Brussels will discuss British plans for reforms in competitiveness, non-discrimination of non-euro members, and curbs on migrant benefits. Thousands of Kosovar opposition supporters protested peacefully on the 8th anniversary of the country's independence Wednesday. The opposition rejected an agreement with Serbia, giving more powers to ethnic Serbs. White House officials say President Obama will visit Cuba next month, more than 6 months after the two Cold War rivals reestablished diplomatic ties. The trip expected as part of Mr. Obama's effort to make as much progress as possible in improving ties with Havana before he leaves office in January. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 18th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. There's been heavy police deployment as Ugandans vote in presidential election today, Thursday.
The deployment is actually something of assurance. It is giving them the confidence that will enable them to leave their home without fear.
Fred Enega is a spokesman for the Ugandan police. Freedom House calls on all parties in the Ugandan election to observe human rights and freedom of expression and participation. Social media offers young Ugandans a platform during the political campaign, and Burundi tells the European Union to give the inter-Burundian dialogue a chance.
I believe that we might not have the same reading of the situation in the country, but I continue to believe that what we have undertaken, that is the inter-Burundian dialogue, is a positive step in the right direction and should be encouraged.
Ali Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister, and the World Health Organization launches a global plan to combat the Zika virus. Those stories plus Mark Omar's sports in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandans are voting today in presidential and parliamentary elections, and joining us from Kampala is VOA's Jill Craig. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, James.
Thank you very much, and welcome to Daybreak Africa. Has voting begun?
Yes, as about, I would say, 5 minutes ago, James, we just saw a truck come to the polling station that I'm currently at, and the truck had three Ugandan police officers who did distribute the ballot papers to the election officials on the ground. Now, prior to this, for the past hour before that, there had been some problems because the polls were supposed to open at 7 a.m., and for about an hour and 10 minutes, at least at the polls that I went to, we found that people had not yet received the ballot papers. But like I said, I think slowly, slowly, they are being distributed.
So was any reason given from, say, election officials why they delay?
Well, I haven't been able to get in touch with anyone at the Electoral Commission yet, James, but the polling officials on the ground told me that they had been told, you know, that that the trucks would be coming shortly. But I don't believe that they were given a reason either. When I asked, they just said that, you know, the drivers would be on their way. So we don't know quite yet exactly what the delay was.
Now, any sign of early voters?
You know, it's interesting. In other East African countries where I've covered the elections, such as Tanzania and Kenya, voters are lining up, you know, when it's still dark outside to their polling station. But in Uganda, what I've found so far, at least in Kampala, is that they have these smaller polling stations. And so you get maybe a handful of people at each one before, you know, at or around 7 o'clock when the polls open. I'm looking at a polling station right now, however, and like I said, it's about a quarter after 8 here in Kampala, and I'm looking at a polling station right now where there's about, I would say, 30 people, you know, lined up outside.
Earlier, we spoke to a spokesperson for the Ugandan police, and he spoke about the heavy deployment of security forces. Any sign that you have seen such a deployment?
What I have seen personally is that we've seen some military and police personnel, you know, sort of walking throughout the city, maybe in trucks, but so far, and, you know, perhaps this will change as the day goes on, but so far I have not seen any sort of, you know, obvious deployment of a large number of troops or police officers. Or again, as I said, the polling stations that I've visited, which now I believe is about 7, so there are, you know, police officers at the polling stations, and, you know, they are around the city, but I have not seen it sort of in force as what I had originally expected.
Jill, thank you very much again for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you, James.
That was VOA's Jill Craig speaking with us live from Uganda's capital, Kampala, where they are voting today in presidential and parliamentary elections. Uganda's security forces have launched an investigation into what they say are intelligence reports that some individuals plan to use fake ballot papers to undermine the integrity of today's general election with the aim to create chaos and destabilize the country. Opposition supporters say the heavy security deployment is intended to intimidate and harass opponents of incumbent President Yoweri Museveni and his governing National Resistance Movement. But police spokesman Fred Enanga says the heavy security deployment is intended to enable voters to participate in the polls without fear.
We are entering into the debate with a lot of confidence on the side of security. There is very good vigilance. We have effectively deployed 4 tires that is beginning from the polling station. Then we are looking at the sub-county, and we have additional deployment of a standby rapid response unit at the district, then additional manpower placed at the regional centers. So I would like to inform you that our structure from the polling station to the national level is effectively covered. All our electoral officials, VIP installations have been effectively secured, and we are just as prepared. The ground is actually very, very conducive for the electioneering process tomorrow.
Wouldn't the heavy deployment of police or security agents to protect the vote intimidate some prospective voters? And how do you counteract that in terms of educating the masses to sensitize them about preparing the grounds for a peaceful vote?
The deployment is actually something of assurance. It is giving them the confidence that will enable them to leave their homes without fear. And also why we've also deployed, you know, towards the end, we've been getting early warning signs of people using politics of fear, playing on the psychology of elected voters and supporters by promoting fear so that they cannot come out to go and vote probably against them.
The Electoral Commission came out expressing concern that some people are planning to use similar or manufactured replicas of the ballot papers to create confusion. How are security agents going to address this concern?
It is intelligence that we are actively investigating. But we've been so proactive, we've been able to go out on various media platforms, the electronic, the print, and the social media, and come out to inform the public that there is cheap propaganda by some, of course, selected political groups and individuals who want to discredit the whole process. Then we are also getting information about those that would want to incite violence and coming up with propaganda through social media, showing that some ballot boxes have been found open and materials missing.
Fred Enenga is the spokesman for the Ugandan police. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. As Ugandans vote today in presidential and parliamentary elections, Freedom House has called on all parties to observe human rights and freedom of expression and participation. Last year, Freedom House downgraded Uganda's civil liberties to increased violations of individual rights and the freedoms of expression, assembly, and association, particularly for opposition supporters. Donna Rukari, Freedom House's chief of party for Uganda, says that assessment remains fairly accurate today as Ugandans go to the polls.
Well, I think right now, as we prepare for the vote later today on Friday the 18th, of course, it's relatively calm. We've had kind of isolated incidents of some of the opposition rallies being, if you wish, pushed back by the state. So I think the position of Freedom House is that we're calling upon all parties in the election to observe the general rules of law, observe human rights, and allow the freedom of expression of everybody within the rules. So we're calling upon all parties to exercise restraint and ensure that we have a cordial and peaceful election later today on the 18th.
In 2015, Freedom House said that Uganda's civil rights rating declined from 4 to 5 and its status declined from partly free to not free due to increased violations of individual rights and the freedoms of expression, assembly, and association, particularly for opposition supporters. Do you stand by this as we go into the election Thursday?
Yes, I think that the recently launched Freedom in the Wild report of Freedom House also, I think, rates Uganda as not free. I think this is mainly in regard to the operating space for journalists and also a number of opposition people. So we believe that the report that was issued recently would be fairly accurate.
And And what does that mean as Ugandans get ready to cast their vote? This may be kind of a cloud hanging over the country. If, say, they're casting their vote and your organization says that this statement remains accurate, can we say that Ugandans are going to the election, that the country is still not free?
I think what we can say is that there's still a number of concerns which need to be kind of not swept under carpet. So questions like, for example, later today, will the Electoral Commission be ready? Will the new biometric system work? Will the media be allowed to cover the election in a free and fair manner? Will we hope they'll not shut down any of the houses in the build-up, especially when it comes to announcing of the results on Saturday, because we have to announce the results within 48 hours according to the law. So I think it's definitely an area of concern, and it's something that we are monitoring and watching in terms of how it will play out between now and the announcement of the results, and also post-election period, what will happen. Because there's a bit of apprehension of the possibility of violence, because a lot of the opposition have been talking defiance. Government also is saying they're ready. So I think this is something that we are monitoring and watching. And as I said, there are some areas of concern as outlined.
Donald Rukari is Freedom House's chief of party for Uganda. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Social media has become an important platform for Ugandans to talk about politics and the state of the nation. Political parties have embraced the use of new media platforms to spread their message. Others use it to spread a message of peace. Shogino Ruzbla has more from Kampala on how social media has shaped the electoral debate in Uganda.
It has already been dubbed Uganda's first social media election. Many people, young and old, have taken to Twitter, Facebook and WhatsApp to give their opinions on the election campaigns and the candidates running for office. Various hashtags have been trending, but the most significant ones were hashtag Uganda Decides and hashtag UGDebate16. Daniel Mumbere, who's an avid social media user and presenter of the TV show Hashtag, has been very happy with the way Ugandans are engaging with politicians on social media.
I would have loved to see where we actually preempt them. We say, let's talk about hospitals today, and then they respond, but it's been the other way around. But I think ultimately it's a good start.
Candidate Amama Mbabazi even announced his presidential bid on YouTube. Media trend watcher Angelo Isama says traditional media do not offer enough for young people who might be interested in the elections.
Traditional media just doesn't have the pace or the space to accommodate all the arguments. Most of the voters are born in the era of the mobile age, so it is generational conversation, which is also done through new technology because, you know, the mobile phone is the default of the new generation.
Smartphones and social media could also be used to monitor polling stations. However, the Electoral Commission has already banned their use.
It's putting us in a position where we have to act extremely carefully, but also with recognizing that with the phone you can do just as much harm as you can do good.
These university students have been going around Kampala since late January with their on- and offline campaign dubbed hashtag IChoosePeaceUG.
I reach out to people, I take a photo, I ask them to take photos with them and then upload on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, WhatsApp, and then a message is spread all over.
They hope to avert the violence that has been seen in previous elections in Uganda.
I'm looking at Uganda where after voting on Thursday, I go back to class on Friday. I don't want to find myself as a refugee in another country.
Social media in Uganda, it's trending. Serginho Rosblatt for VOA News, Kampala.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 18th, and still to come, Mark Ullman's sports in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Burundi's foreign minister says the inter-Burundian dialogue is a positive step in the right direction and should be encouraged. Earlier this week, the European Union foreign minister said the EU was prepared to impose sanctions on Burundians who have contributed to the country's violence as well as those who have hampered a political solution. But Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe says he hopes the external part of the dialogue, which is led by the East African community, will be expedited and once agreement is reached on the agenda and who should participate.
Movement there is and movement there will be. I believe that we might not have the same reading of the situation in the country, But I continue to believe that what we have undertaken, that is the inter-Burundian dialogue, which has been, you know, started in Burundi by the National Dialogue Commission, is a positive step in the right direction and should be encouraged. Now, there's also the external facet of the dialogue, which also needs to be developed and take its full steam. But as you know, the facilitation has been engulfed in election. Now that the elections will be done, we hope that soon after the elections, the facilitator will then have more time, you know, to consecrate to that specific aspect. And I don't think it will take that long, actually, because once we agree on who should participate and on the agenda, I think that we can be able to move forward as fast as we can.
When you talk about when we agree who should participate, can it be assumed that your government is the one holding up the discussions? Because I think the other people are willing to talk, and you are picking and choosing.
Well, I do not know of any legitimate government which would not be rigorous when it comes to issues of participation in any dialogue. I believe that all over the world, issues of rights to partake in a political process are regarded very seriously. It is not all the citizens of the country, for instance, who participate in the elections. Some are deprived of the right to vote, those, for instance, who are in jail. Others have the right to participate in some conditions. It applies to the same to this process of dialogue, because I believe that some of the people who claim the right to participate in the dialogue are not peaceful stakeholders, and yet the UN Security Council has called on all peaceful stakeholders to partake with the government in the dialogue, and that is Resolution 2248. So it is not too much asking when we are saying that that resolution needs to be upheld.
I spoke with FRODEBU leader, Dr. Jean Minani, and he said that on the U.S. and your government's accusation of Rwanda of supporting Burundian refugees to destabilize your government, that is a strategy by your government to deflect international attention on the lack of progress in the dialogue.
Well, what do you expect from him? Talking from his own masters, that's all. I cannot make any more comment. Did you ask him where he spoke from?
Yes, maybe I spoke with him from Kigali.
Wonderful. So, like master, like servant, period.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Members of civil society groups in South Sudan are asking the government and the SPLM in opposition to silence the guns and respect the permanent ceasefire signed by both President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar. As Philipton Alel reports for VOA from Juba, activists told the SPLM in opposition-led negotiator that patience among South Sudanese is wearing out.
Akwaj Ajang, chairperson of the Civil Society Alliance, says the long overdue formation of the transitional government of national unity is holding progress on implementing the August peace deal. Ajang says South Sudanese must speak up about the suffering of the people because of the continued fighting in some parts of the country.
The gun are not silenced in some places within the country, which is very unfortunate. There's no point that a citizen can die at this time while the agreement has been already signed. There's no solution that can be reached through guns. It has been more than 2 years already, and the government and IO have been fighting each other. Having reached any solution by guns, of course, no.
The Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMEC, is the body tasked with monitoring the implementation process of the peace deal. Ajang says South Sudanese must remind President Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar about the dire humanitarian conditions in the Recep Amadi State, one of the new states created by President Kiir, along with other parts of the country where government troops and the SPLA in position forces are still fighting. SPLM IO lead negotiator Taban Dengai says his group is preparing for Machar's arrival in Juba. Guy did not specify any fixed dates, but insists his group is making arrangements for transporting Machar's bodyguard and forces to Juba.
We have suggested that half of the 2,910 should come from Pagak, from Malakal, and Tarjas in Unity State to Juba by air, so that they come sooner, quicker, for the first vice president to come. We are being faced with the issue of logistics, because it's not simple to hire a plane from Juba to go to Pagak to bring forces.
Guy says the tracker countries, the United States, Norway, and Britain, have pledged to provide funds to help transport Machar forces. He says once they are in Juba, the transitional government of national unity will be formed. For VOA News, I am Pilithona Leo in Juba.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on football. Host South Africa will play Mozambique in the opening encounter at the Futsal Africa Cup of Nations in Johannesburg on the 15th of April. According to the draws held here in Johannesburg on Wednesday, Zambia and Tunisia are also in Group A preliminaries. Egypt is seeded in Group B, which also features Libya, Angola and Morocco. The top three teams qualify for the Futsal FIFA World Cup in Colombia later this year. I caught up with the Mozambique coach, Naimo Abdul, and asked him for his impressions of the draw.
I think that the draw has gone very well. Yes, all the team that qualified to the CAF Futsal is very good teams, and I haven't the preference. In our group, we have big teams. Each team can qualify to the final or semifinals.
Now, the Mozambique Federation, what is the target that Mozambique Federation gave you?
Okay, the target that Mozambique gave us is to qualify Mozambique to the World Cup Futsal Colombia, and that's why I came here, and I'm sure that we'll do this with or without difficulties. We'll be there in Colombia.
That was Naimo Abdul, the Mozambique Futsal National Team coach, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. Meanwhile, Egypt will open their campaign in Group B against Libya. They were finalists at the last edition of this Futsal Championships, which Libya hosted and won in 2008. Egyptian team representative Osama Shukri is clear about their expectation.
Well, I believe every team is looking forward to win the competition. It doesn't matter which team we are playing against. We are playing for the competition, for the fun. As I told you, we are looking forward to accumulate more championships.
That was Osama Shukri, the Egyptian futsal team representative, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 18th. On this day in 1931, African-American novelist Toni Morrison was born in Lorain, Ohio. Most of her writings portrayed the double-edged character of Black lives from inside their own histories and cultures. In 1987, Morrison won the Pulitzer Prize for her novel Beloved. In 1993, Morrison was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. On this day in 1867, Augusta Institute was founded at Augusta, Georgia, which was later to become Morehouse College. Following its relocation to Atlanta, Morehouse College is one of the most prestigious Black colleges in the United States. Day to know that James H. Meredith was the first African-American student to enroll at the University of Mississippi. While attending the all-Black Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi, Meredith applied to the all-white University of Mississippi. After he was rejected because of his race, Meredith sued for admission, and the university was ordered to admit him. Meredith's landmark enrollment at the University of Mississippi and his 1966 Walk Against Fear were central events in the U.S. Civil Rights Movement. On this day in African history, in 1965, Gambia achieved its independence from the United Kingdom. The country is currently led by President Yahya Jammeh, who in 1994 led a bloodless coup d'etat against the founding president, Sir Dauda Jawara. And on this day in African history, in 1985, at least 8 people were killed by South African police during clashes with rioters in the shanty town of Crossroads, Cape Town. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 18th. Congratulations to Alec Mbewe of Solowezi, Zambia, and Williams Yaba Ibrahim of Jos, Plateau State, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 17th question: which African-American singer is considered the Empress of the Blues? The answer, Bessie Smith. Now, here is our question for today, February 18th. Which African-American scientist invented the wooden churn, a device that made it easier to convert cream into butter? Once again, which African-American scientist invented the wooden churn, a device that made it easier to convert cream into butter? Send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Thursday, February 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botti, Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.